Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical discussion, debate, dialogue, healthcare and science in the news, healthcare policy, and answers to your questions, be they either email or telephone. It's all here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. We had some very, very interesting stories this week, and I'm going to start off with talking about very important research coming out on breast cancer. Breast cancer has an interesting history going back to the very first mastectomy performed, well, basically in the 19th century by a Dr. Halsted, and coming forward to further and further refinements of surgical and chemotherapeutical and radiation nuanced therapy for breast cancer. Well, it's been a standard practice for a long time that if a woman with breast cancer is found to have any lymph nodes in her underarm also positive for breast cancer, she undergoes removal of the lymph nodes in her underarm. And this procedure damages the drainage from the arm in many cases, leading to a uncomfortable condition called lymphedema. Now, we've all seen lymphedema in the ankles of elderly people with varicose veins, where everything is just really puffed out. And the African disease elephantiasis, which is caused by a parasite blocking the lymph channels, is also a kind of lymphedema. So we know what that looks like. And you can imagine having that in an arm, something that you want to move all the time would be painful. And in some cases, it's actually quite disabling. Well, a new study shows that women with small size tumors, even if their breast cancer is found in the lymph nodes, don't really need to have those lymph nodes removed. The study, which was, I think, a very good study done out of the John Wayne Cancer Institute, looked at data from 445 women who had either a T1 or a T2. That means basically a tumor that's under a 2 centimeters, under an inch in size. And they looked at another 446 women who did not have their lymph nodes removed. Both sets of women got chemotherapy and radiation, in other words, otherwise appropriate care that does have data that shows prolonged survival if you do it. And looking at least at 5-year survival, there was no improvement in the women who had their lymph nodes removed. So I guess the way to frame this is that if your lymph nodes are positive but your tumor is small, the chemo and the radiation are enough to eliminate cells not only in those lymph nodes but also anywhere else in your body where they may have taken root. Extremely important because it allows us to treat a certain subgroup of cancer patients in a way that is less of a slash and burn way that leaves less damage in its wake. Another important study, this one actually from a more obscure journal, the American Journal of Physiology, is a really important women's health issue as well, and that's polycystic ovary disease, or Stein-Leventhal syndrome. Women with polycystic ovary disease have, well, among other things, lots of cysts on their ovaries a great deal of the time, but they also have too much testosterone and high insulin levels. They have a sort of hormonal orchestra cacophony. And in that situation, things become dysregulated and the women suffer from a lot of physiologic side effects. It has been shown in this latest study that exercise helps polycystic ovary syndrome, but acupuncture helps it even more. In this subgroup, women were treated with electrical signals, or a very weak electrical current, rather, applied to acupuncture needles in their pelvis. And this is an acupuncture protocol that any acupuncturist is really familiar with. They were using e-stimulation on it as well. They did better than the control group, and they did better on the group that was exercising 3 times a week, which was sort of a secondary control group. So the concept is that we're changing the signaling somehow with the acupuncture in a favorable way. Very important plus. I have more women's health coming up, but I have a couple of stories that I want to be sure I mention about children. First of all, there's been a recall of baby monitors. This company is called Summer Infant Inc. And if you have a baby monitor that comes from that company, you will want to take it away. There have been two cases of strangulation, and that's out of 1.7 million baby monitors. But basically, if you've made a device that any infant can manage to strangle himself or herself on, it probably needs to be taken out of the nursery PDQ. So hopefully this, as well as other information about that recall, will reach all of the people who need to hear it. Now, you've often heard me talk about the different kinds of food sensitivities and mention that there is IgE, which is the allergic antibody. That's the one where you eat peanuts and you wheeze. But also there's IgG, which is very controversial in medical circles, whether this is a meaningful issue. And I have evidence here that I'm about to tell you about that suggests that it is. So let me just recapitulate what IgG is. IgG is a type of antibody that circulates in your bloodstream. It's the antibody that is most commonly evoked when we do vaccinations. And it grabs whatever it has been designed to attack and holds onto it and acts like, well, basically a orange freeway cone to the immune system saying there's trouble here. And that causes the immune complex, that is to say the IgG and whatever it's glommed onto, to be absorbed by macrophages and removed by lymph nodes and removed by the spleen. This is a very important part of the immune system. And many of us have elevated levels of IgG to certain foods. Now, in this study, 50 children with ADHD, that is to say, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, were tested to see whether they had elevated IgG. And what they did was they took all 50 children and gave them an elimination diet, which takes out the most common food antigens like corn, soy, and wheat. The children who seemed to improve in their behavior after 5 weeks on the elimination diet were tested to see what they were sensitive to. So of the responder group, the ones who had elevated IgG to certain foods were basically kept away from those foods, and they showed a persistence in their improved behavior. A further part of the study was challenging, so children who had high levels of IgG to certain foods were then given those foods, and compared to children who did not have an elevated IgG to those foods, there was a deterioration in their behavior with re-exposure. There have been lots of alternative things over the years talking about the Feingold diet, talking about various types of diets for children, and it's all been very much poo-pooed by placebo-controlled double-blind studies. And the problem is you have to test the responders. It's hard to do placebo food studies anyway, but realistically, there's a subgroup of the population that responds to these alternative methods. Identify the responders and test them to understand the mechanism. Don't test the entire group because only a part of the group has this problem as an explanation for their disorder. And our ability to distinguish in a large study just gets diluted out and you fail to reach statistical significance and you miss the boat. We need to do subgroup analysis and we need to be testing the responders with a placebo trial, not just testing the herd. And we're going to our first caller, and that is Nancy from Port Townsend, Washington. Nancy, hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Well, I never get headaches, and I've been having whoppers the last couple of weeks. It's located right behind my eyes. It's very painful, and like if I lean over, it feels like my head is going to explode, but it doesn't feel like my sinuses are plugged up. So I'm just wondering what kind of headaches these might be.
First of all, you've given me a huge clue with the when I bend forward, I get increased in the headaches.
Yeah.
You don't feel like your sinuses are plugged up, probably because the sinuses that you're used to being aware of, which are the maxillaries in the cheek below your eye, and the frontals above the eyebrows are fine. But there are other sinuses that are between the eyes. There's the ethmoids and the sphenoids. And I suspect that you have a blockage in those sinuses and probably some backed up fluid. And that when you lean forward, that fluid shifts forward and you trigger the stretch receptors in the sinuses and get an increase in your pain. A good way to test this would be to use steam and a mucus thinner. I like guaifenesin, which is spelled G-U-A-I-F-E-N-E-S-I-N. It's the primary ingredient in plain Robitussin, and it's in a lot of cough medications. But you want the plain guaifenesin without any decongestants or antihistamines. That drug, so far as I know, doesn't interact with anything, any pharmaceuticals, so it's I can suggest you take it without any precautions. Try taking some of that and then getting a bowl of boiling water and doing a facial steam for maybe 5 or 10 minutes. During that time, see if your headache improves. It may even reduce significantly and then come back, which would be very strong evidence that that's what you've got. May not be an infection. It could just be clogging. I don't know what the weather's up like up in Port Townsend, but I can tell you down here, we've got pollen galore floating around. And so the allergy season is arrived very early this year.
No, we've got cold and really cold and 20 degrees and 30 degrees. And,
okay, so maybe an indoor mold or maybe even just an upper respiratory infection.
Yeah.
But anyway, headaches that worry us are headaches that have visual symptoms, headaches that are ones like left-sided. Anyone who develops a pulsatile migraine-like headache after the age of 45 who hasn't previously had migraines worries me, and we'll generally do brain imaging under those circumstances. The vast majority of headaches have nothing to do with brain pathology. A very, very small percentage of them do, and so if your headache persists and you're not finding any change with the steaming program that I've described, then I would seek medical attention.
If it is an infection and not a clog, and the steaming, will the steaming still help it or not?
If you had a sinus infection, I would expect you to have inflammatory findings such as fever, purulent drainage, something like that.
Okay.
You could have a sinus infection that's more indolent and kind of rolling along, but even in those situations, the steaming usually will help temporarily and give us a clue that we need to look in the sinuses.
I did make an appointment with my eye doctor because it is time. I can't get in for a couple of weeks, but I just thought I'd check that angle, too, in case there was something. But it sounds like it's more in the sinus than...
Yeah, the bending over thing isn't very consistent with eye issues. Now, you could have an odd referral pain from the neck. Sometimes people with a headache generated in the back of the head will experience pain between the eyes. And headaches are funny because in Chinese medicine, there are a bunch of headache syndromes like the Shaoyang headache and the Taiyang headache, which correspond to headaches I've seen clinically, but they don't correspond to headaches as I was trained to parse them out in Western medicine. So, yeah, I would see a Western medicine doctor. I would definitely try the steaming. And if your headache is also associated with nausea and vomiting, that's a headache that needs to be imaged.
Right. Well, and thank you for your show, and hooray for testing subgroups.
Hooray for testing subgroups. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, I have another interesting story about that that we'll try to get to later in the show. I wanted to do a follow-up to Beth in Boulder Creek. Beth called last week to talk about GMO foods, and we've ordered a couple of those books and are researching the topic, and we'll try to take up the subject on a future show. I wanted to get a couple of emails in before we take our next caller. This one to Peggy in Moss Landing. Reclast versus Prolia for osteoporosis. Now, Peggy had previously emailed, but I'm going to do a little abstract here. She's 59. She had a normal bone scan in 2006, went through menopause, dropped her bone density in her lumbar spine, and qualifies for osteoporosis, which means she has a T-score of less than 2.5, which means she has a risk of fracture of about 4 times that of healthy 30-year-old women with a fully mineralized spine. Here is her issue. Her doctor has recommended Reclast or Prolia for her osteoporosis. Now, Reclast is a bisphosphonate. It's given once a year, And I strongly recommend against this bisphosphonate compared to the oral bisphosphonates. It's being promoted as better because it doesn't have the gastrointestinal side effects. And if you have GERD or heartburn, it's dangerous to take a bisphosphonate. That's true. On the other hand, the injectable bisphosphonates are the ones that have been most closely linked with osteonecrosis, which is a chronic infection of the jaw that is very bad for your health and very hard to diagnose. And we have seen it in menopausal women, but we've seen it far more commonly in people who are using higher doses of bisphosphonate for cancer, and particularly the injectable bisphosphonates. So I'm giving a hold to back away slowly on injectable bisphosphonates until we see that they don't drastically increase the risk of a very rare but very nasty side effect. Now, Prolia, on the other hand, is not a back away slowly drug, it's a back away quickly drug. Prolia is a monoclonal antibody that is designed to attack one of the compounds that's found in your bone. The effect of attacking this enzyme is to prevent bone breakdown. Now, that's all very good, but monoclonal antibodies have been associated with increased risk of cancer and increased risk of serious life-threatening infections. And the FDA approved this for first-line therapy of osteoporosis, which is just plain nuts. This is not a drug that is ready for prime time. Let's wait 10 years. Let's make sure that we don't see an increase in cancer with this particular monoclonal antibody, as has been seen with some of the rheumatoid arthritis monoclonals. Now, if you are crippled, can't move, are in constant pain, yeah, take a shot, get yourself better, improve your quality of life drastically, and yes, a cancer risk, fine, I'll take that. Risk benefit makes sense to me. On the other hand, osteoporosis, you haven't even had a fracture yet. You don't even know that this person is going to fracture, and you're going to give them a drug that could conceivably give them cancer? I'm sorry, that is out of line, and I'm very, very sorry that the FDA approved this drug in the first place. Let's go to a next caller who is Anonymous in Santa Cruz. Anonymous, you're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hello.
Yeah, I have a question. It's regarding my friend. He's on 8 different prescriptions. He's paraplegic, and so a lot of those drugs are related to that. And basically, he's been on Ativan, 1 milligram, for probably about 10 years. He takes it probably about 3 times in 24 hours, so 3 milligrams. So he asked his doctor recently, because we know that that's not really a long-term drug. For,
well, how long has he been on it?
Like I say, about 10 years.
Well, it's a long-term drug for him.
Yeah.
And he's now physiologically habituated to it.
Yes, he is. But he asked her about possibly switching to Buspirone.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yeah, that's a great idea. And then I looked it up in my nurse's drug guide, and it said specifically that benzodiazepines are withdrawn gradually before Buspirone therapy is started.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and she said when he asked her, well, will I need to withdraw off the Ativan? She just said, no, you can just stop and take the Buspar. And that was a total red flag for me, so I looked it up, and now I can see no. So I want to ask you.
Well, I'm with you on this. I would always withdraw benzos very slowly, particularly even if you've been on it for 6 months, I would use caution. But over a year, there are physiologic adaptations that occur in the brain that actually lower the seizure threshold. So going cold turkey out of benzos, even a dose of 3 milligrams a day, which is not a high dose, would significantly, I mean, when I say significant, I mean statistically significant in terms of the absolute magnitude of the risk. I can't quantify it for you, but increased seizure threshold, we don't do.
I mean,
that's just not an option. What would make sense would be to start the Buspar, which takes a while to work anyway, and when you have gotten up to a therapeutic level, usually titrating up on Buspar because of the nausea and headache, which are common early side effects. And when you get the person up to a therapeutic level, maybe 15 milligrams twice a day or something like that, then you back off on the benzos, a dose of perhaps 5, 10%, maybe 5% a week or 10% per month. And you use jitters, tremors, agitation as an indicator symptom for not backing off further.
Okay, here's my question, doctor. Specifically quoted in this book, it says benzodiazepines are withdrawn gradually before Buspirone therapy is started.
Well, I would cross the therapy. I don't believe there's any reason to hold off. I disagree with that recommendation.
Okay.
At least clinically, that's not how I do it. Now, I may get 5,000 calls from pharmacists telling me that I'm not doing it right, but I've been not doing it right for 20 years, so I am going to stand on my clinical approach.
That's what matters. Yeah, Okay. So he could take it simultaneously as long as he titrates the Buspirone up and titrates the Ativan down.
I think that it would be wise to get a second opinion from another doctor.
Yeah.
I don't think you should go against your doctor's advice on the basis of what somebody on the radio tells you.
Okay,
but I think a second opinion is definitely called for because I disagree with the first one you've gotten.
Okay, and then let's see. The other thing is, I'm wondering, like, if he is, when he is withdrawing off the Ativan, and of course I'll ask another doctor, his doctor, would it be appropriate to have something like a very short-term acting beta blocker for if he goes into total sympathetic nervous system overload with a heart pounding and sweating?
It would depend on what else he's taking. You said he's on about 8 meds, and beta blockers interact with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So I think that's a possibility as long as you aren't going to run into another drug side effect by doing it.
Exactly. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
I want to read another email. This one's from Sally in Pacific Grove. Lyme disease. I was bitten by a tick January 2004. I was one of the fortunate one-third of people who actually get a rash, tipping me off to see my doctor. I was treated for my acute flu-like symptoms with 2 weeks of antibiotic and told I was cured. As the 7 years after that went by, I grew more and more ill, suffering from fevers, migraines, dizziness, skin lesions, tremors, neurologic problems, and severe joint pain, eventually losing my mobility. Seeking help, I was referred to countless doctors and specialists and told I had everything from a psychological problem to multiple sclerosis, lupus, Parkinson's, malaria, and chronic neurologic Lyme disease. Through what I can only refer to as divine intervention, I met a brilliant and caring infectious disease specialist named Dr. David Craig Wright. I'm going to skip over some of the biographical things here. With a blood test drawn by Questlab, he diagnosed me with a West Coast variant of Lyme called Borrelia hermsii. After his 42-day antibiotic infusion treatment in August and September of 2010, I'm symptom-free and consider myself completely cured of this infection. Dr. Wright has given me my life back. I recommend that anyone who has just been bitten by a tick or anyone believes they are dealing with a tick-borne infection contact Dr. Wright's office. Thank you so much for sharing this with your radio audience. I would also offer anyone hearing who can contact me by email to confirm the sincerity of my story, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I just want to say, Sally, we hear you. And those of you who are regular listeners may remember a caller who had been on the air about 6 months ago with chronic Lyme disease, who eventually did come to see me in my alternative medicine office. He had lost the ability to get the regular infusions of Rocephin, which he had been getting from a local oncologist. When that practice closed, he was left high and dry with no way to continue a therapy, which he felt was critical for his continued quality of life. And he had a similar story where he had improvement with treatment, but never really fully recovered and then would relapse after a period of time. Well, in looking for someone who would do infusion therapy, I came across Dr. Wright and tracked him down and have actually interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, and we're preparing that interview for a broadcast in March. So we will be talking a lot about Borrelia hermsii, and I just wanted to take a moment, acknowledge the issue, and pre-promote an upcoming show. Let's talk to Marilyn in Felton. Hello, Marilyn, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
I was diagnosed with a splenic tumor in December 21st and had a splenectomy January 4th, and it was diagnosed as lymphoma and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and I found out a week ago that it was stage 1, and I will start chemo next week, 4 rounds of R-CHOP, if you're familiar with that regimen, and I wanted to find out what your take is on complementary medicine that may help me during my chemo. And I've had some offers from friends who do acupuncture to give me acupuncture treatments, which I will take. And have heard about very many things. And my doctor, oncologist, is not very supportive of doing supplements that may interfere in some way. He doesn't know. But my question is about Paul Stamets's mushrooms and L-glutamine and anything else you might offer.
Okay. Well, the first approach that I have when a patient comes to me with this sort of an issue in my office is to review the chemotherapy regimen and then do a search for known interactions. And there are known interactions between certain nutritionals and chemotherapy regimens. You know, looking at the published study, more than half of the interactions are actually positive. That is to say that the nutritional is synergistic with the chemo. And then there are very few which are negative. And what has happened, for oncologists at least, is that the negative studies are the ones that they've been educated about. And the positive studies, I don't know why, they're just not as promoted. And so because of the bias towards pharmaceuticals that exist in medical culture in general, but oncology culture in particular, there's kind of this hear no evil, you know, three monkeys thing, you know, see no evil, hear no evil. It's like people don't want to hear it. They don't want to think about it. Some oncologists don't go to the literature, or if they do go to the literature, unless their academy is making the statement, they don't want to make the statement because they're afraid of being sued. And one of the problems you have with oncology is that people get very angry with the fact that they have cancer. It's not a nice death many times. The family is very unhappy that their husband, wife, son, daughter, mother, father has cancer. And there's a lot of blaming going on and a lot of hostility. As a doctor, you feel very threatened by that. And a lot of times one is attacked by the family, and it's very, very wounding. And I can speak from personal experience on that. So wounding, you think about whether or not you can keep on practicing medicine. It's just, it's big. And a lot of doctors, when I had that experience and I talked to them, they were like, well, you just have to realize the patient's the enemy, the family's the enemy, and you need to protect your butt. And if you're an oncologist, the way you protect your butt is by doing everything the academy says is okay and not doing anything that the academy says isn't okay. And that stinks. No question about it. What I do is I use some common sense and I trust in doing the right thing. So I go to the literature, which is ample, and there is lots of literature about synergistic effects, and I make certain recommendations based on that. Now, there were a few things that we know you don't do with certain chemotherapy agents, but there are a lot of things that can be taken. And you asked about mushrooms, and I'll speak to that one particularly. There's no data anywhere, period, amen. There's no data that any of the mushroom products interfere with chemotherapy. And because they aren't antioxidants per se, there's not even a theoretical reason why they should interfere with chemotherapy. There is one instance, and I don't remember which chemo agent it is, but there's only one instance that shows that vitamin E interferes with chemo. And I don't remember which chemo agent it is, but that's the one where I tell people don't take vitamin E. But in general, vitamin E has been shown across the board to improve apoptosis, which is cell death of cancer cells, preferentially. And I have an article right here that I was going to talk about. Let me see if I can find it. This had been in the reference to my health tip. So let me give my health tip for the day, since you have set me up for it.
Okay.
And this is the health tip. If you are a cancer survivor or you have cardiovascular disease, you're going to have a lot of studies involving ionizing radiation, either CT scans or angiograms, and you might have multiple studies over the years. And recent research has shown that there is an increased risk of cancer after appropriate therapy for cardiovascular disease, just because of the radiation hit you get from the appropriate therapy. Now, what does that mean realistically? It means if you have a bunch of x-rays, if you have a CT scan, if you have an angiogram, if you have a nuclear med study for your heart, or if you're getting radiation therapy for cancer, you should seek to improve the antioxidant properties of your diet. And I will be posting on the website a link to a journal article, this from the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 134, that's November 2004. And this article talks primarily about vitamin E, and selenium, aged garlic extract, and iodine as compounds that probably everyone who's receiving radiation therapy or getting radiation to guide therapy for, let's say, cancer or cardiovascular disease should be doing. With respect to antioxidants in general, I am a great believer in food-based antioxidants. In other words, go buy the organic spinach and the organic apples and the organic carrots and blend them up and drink them and drink tons of the stuff every day. It's going to provide your body with nutritional substances for which there is very, very great evidence improves survival rate and reduces the chance of recurrent cancer and reduces the side effects of the chemo. And there is no data against doing that. That's the thing. The oncologists are not practicing scientific-based medicine. They're practicing litigation-based fear. And I don't blame them, but as a patient or as a primary care doctor who isn't expected to know any better, I'm going to recommend a healthy diet.
The oncology nurse mentioned that I should probably avoid antioxidants because they are anti-cancer.
Wait. So she said they're anti-cancer, so you should avoid them.
Well, because
what part of that makes
because
sense?
Of the chemo process.
What part of that makes sense?
She said right before the chemo to, you know, not have a lot of carrots.
And what part of that makes sense? You need to question when something doesn't make sense. You need to question whether or not it's science-based or fear-based. And
I guess her thought was that it interferes with the chemo itself.
There's no evidence for that. That's what I'm saying. There's no evidence for that at all. And in fact, there's good evidence to the contrary.
Mm.
That is some protocol somewhere that some lawyer cooked up to tell the doctor that they won't get sued for a bad outcome. But there's no basis for it, none whatsoever, in the scientific literature. And if we don't start basing our therapy on the scientific literature, then we deserve to be drummed out of medicine and have some board of something or other appointed by the government give us guidelines to tell us how to practice medicine. And if we can't do a good job ourselves, then I guess maybe we do need a government agency doing it for us. But I am really sick of this, don't eat a healthy diet, don't take antioxidants because it might interfere with your chemo, when there's no data for that. There just isn't. There are a few antioxidant interactions, but most of the data supports that it's going to create a favorable outcome. And like I said, there's tons of references.
Is there a good website?
No, there isn't. Yeah. There's no single one good website. There are a lot of books out there, but this is controversial. And, you know, the web is full of factual errors.
That's why I haven't gone there, actually.
Yeah. I think that there's good stuff there, too, but you have to consider the source and consider, you know, what the people writing this website expect to gain by having this website. You know, what are they selling?
Yeah.
And who's funding them? I mean, there's lots of really fine informational websites funded by drug companies, but they're always sort of pushing drug therapy, you know? Funny about that. Well, I think that the first thing to say is that I don't agree with the advice that you've been given.
Okay.
And the second thing to say is that there's a wonderful site called Google Scholar. And you can go to Google Scholar and you can put in the name of your chemo drug and you can put in the name of any antioxidant or any vitamin that you're wondering about, and you can see whether there is any published paper anywhere that shows benefit or risk with the use of this combination. And if you find a benefit paper and no downside paper, then there probably isn't a downside. If you want, you can come and see me at my office and we'll go through this process itself. My go to the Ask Dr. Don site and just link to the functional medicine practice. And I want to emphasize, this is not primary care. This is not something I do in my primary care office. This is research, and it is consultation, and it's not primary care. And I won't accept $38.50 that Blue Cross will pay me to do it. Forget it. So have a good day. And I really don't mean to be harsh with you. It's more along the lines of being harsh with bad advice that you've been given.
No, I hear that. I'm not taking it personally. I'm just looking for the balanced middle road of what's reasonable and healthy.
Well, go take a look at that article that I will publish, that I'll publish the link on, okay?
Yeah. Okay,
Start with that.
Thanks for being there.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. I want to put out a compliment to one local oncologist, and that's Dr. Michael Yen, who I've been sending articles to and sending patients in with advice and saying, you know, check it out with him. Here's the reference. And he's been receptive and open to actually looking at the data. And that isn't a universal stance. And so I want to give him a really strong compliment for actually having an open scientific mind, which is what all doctors are supposed to have. Let's go to Bruce in Prunedale. Hello, Bruce, and welcome to the program. Hi.
Yes. I just wanted to comment. Doctors I've been dealing with are in their 50s and went through college about the time I did. And at that time, a person can get a medical degree with taking just one class in nutrition. I don't know how much.
Wait. Say that again.
Taking one course in nutrition.
Okay. So a person who got trained in medicine only had a one course in nutrition is what you mean.
Right. So yes. I've never looked at doctors as people that I would go to for nutritional advice.
Not unless they've studied it extensively outside of the primary curriculum. You're quite right.
Yeah. So I think when people go to their doctor with that expectation that they should ask them about what they should be eating or not eating or so forth, or beneficial foods during chemotherapy, they should realize that their doctor doesn't have really a lot of knowledge necessarily. You're, I think, exceptional in terms of your interest.
The information's there, but you have to go after it. And what has happened in medical culture is that we sit passively in our office and people with an agenda come to us with slanted educational information. And that's what we get. We get slanted information that's brought to us by drug companies. And we go to conferences, which are partially funded by drug companies. And sometimes the papers actually critique drugs, but what gets accepted for publication and where the funding is this huge, gnarly iceberg of interconnections and conflict of interest that makes all data essentially suspect at some level or other.
Especially now when a third of the FDA funding is coming from private industry.
Oh, God, that is so spooky.
But I wondered on the osteoporosis information where you'd indicated not to do those, the two therapies that are being offered for somebody with osteoporosis. What do you recommend instead?
Well, I individualize therapy based on the patient's clinical situation, so I can't give specific advice. But theoretically, I tend to use the SERMs, which are the selective estrogen modulators or hormone therapy, as my first-line therapy for osteopenia or osteoporosis, because the risks for particularly for the SERMs, they seem to be anti-breast cancer drugs. So it's like, okay, I've got a drug that lowers your risk of breast cancer, lowers your risk of cardiovascular disease, lowers your risk of a fracture. What part of this is bad? And, cost, because Evista's more expensive than estrogen. But if people have a cancer history, that's where I go. The bisphosphonates I used to view as, pretty good drugs. But in the light of these long-term papers that are coming out now where we're seeing small but statistically significant increased risk of esophageal cancer, don't like that one. Small but statistically significant risk of weird mid-shaft femur fractures, don't like that one much either. And, of course, this osteonecrosis issue, which I alluded to earlier. So I see long-term, not necessarily the greatest drug in the world, and do I really need to use this in this individual? Versus something else, vitamin D, weight-bearing exercise, and remembering that how I would manage a patient who has already had a pathological fracture is different than how I would manage a person who technically has the disease because they have a low score. Because there are other factors, such as family history, such as bone microstructure, that we can't measure with
a bone scan. I was speaking more to the osteoporosis in the spine, where it could affect, I guess, disc retention.
It does
like that.
Not affect disc retention. They're two separate issues. The disc is a fibroelastic structure between the bones. If you have osteoporotic fractures and you have wedge fractures of your spine, that's going to put more of a strain on your discs. But protecting the discs is not why we take these drugs. We do it to protect the vertebral body, to keep the spine from having the collapse fracture in the first place.
So for the disc, it'd be better just to do muscular muscle strengthening exercises?
And pick the right parents.
Okay.
A very important part of disc disease, by the way.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. Let's talk to Joan in Felton. Hello, Joan, and welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Okay. I'm calling because 6 years ago, I had a meningioma brain tumor. It's an atypical meningioma, and I had surgery, and then 3 years ago, it started growing back, and up at UCSF, I had the Gamma Knife, surgery for it, and it worked until now. And now it's growing back again. And the problem is that after the Gamma Knife surgery, I had terrible adverse reactions. It stopped the tumor from growing. But my face, I mean, I just swelled. My whole head and face swelled up bright red. It eventually turned, and it went on and on. It didn't, you know, I went on Decadron, and eventually it became rosacea. And now I can't be in the sun, you know, I tried going to Hawaii last summer and forget it. You know, I was out of the sun. I did everything I could, but my face just was a mess. So the big question is, should I have another Gamma Knife for this new tumor that has just started? And part of the complication is my father was a doctor, and when I was a teenager, since my mother had had acne, they decided that I should have my face radiated every week for 4 years. From the time I was 13 till the time I was 17, I went to the radiologist and got my face radiated.
And this was with an X-ray machine?
Yes.
So you have sustained significant potential mutational damage to the skin of your face. And also, I might add, your growing brain cells back there in your teens, which may in fact have indirectly led to your atypical meningioma, because this is sort of like a basal cell skin tumor, the way it's behaving, you know?
Right. It's like my cousin had it too, and she got thyroid cancer from it. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, those are common cancers. And your rosacea, you were probably set up for it. So when they went at you with another radiation, different kind, the Gamma Knife is a different type of radiation, but still causes the same sort of thing, increased free radicals production in your cells and DNA damage. So effectively, I think it kicked over the rosacea, and now you have a chronic self-regulating, self-perpetuating autoimmune, or not autoimmune, but inflammatory condition. And you're probably going to get worse if you do the Gamma Knife again.
Exactly. And you know, they're telling me, I love the doctor up there, but I said, isn't the radiation going to do more damage? And she said, oh, no, the radiation won't bother your skin. And she knows this history.
Well, I think that she is mistaken, but I'm sure that she is considering the risk-benefit aspect. I would say to you, what are your therapeutic options? You have a brain tumor.
Right.
It's going to grow. It's going to damage your brain and give you effectively like a stroke.
Right.
By squeezing bits of your brain until they don't function anymore. This is not a survivable situation.
Exactly. Well, I know that very well.
What are your options? What's your surgical option? Are there other procedures that could be done? Other types of ablation? I would wonder about whether it could be done using, say, a radiofrequency ablation device or using some other type of technology. And I think you absolutely need to pursue alternative treatments for this. What I would start with is actually, where do you live?
In Felton.
All right. So come down and work with the librarian at Dominican Hospital to search on meningioma, your type of meningioma, so you'll need the exact wording of your kind of cancer, and the therapies that might be available. The NIH has a wonderful cancer site that lists all of the different therapies for the various cancers, because there are therapeutic options. Now, the person who spent, let's say, $10 million to buy a Gamma Knife and works for the Gamma Knife company is probably going to tell you you need a Gamma Knife treatment.
They're at the University of San Francisco, UCSF,
which,
and they developed it.
They might not be entirely objective about the other therapies.
I see.
I am sure are alternative therapies. And even if the Gamma Knife is the best therapy for 100 people, how much better is it when you know that you're not 100 people, you're you, and you have already had a serious adverse reaction to the Gamma Knife.
Mm-hmm.
And no, most people don't get that. So the point is, you already know you're at risk. So you can't look at what happens to 100 people. You have to look at what happened to you and say, is there anything else I can do that will work as well or almost as well on my tumor that doesn't involve this potential horrendous side effect that might be much worse this time?
Well, it would have to be something, you mean, that wasn't radiation?
Yeah, I'd look at what are the alternatives?
Because there are things that aren't radiation.
There are things that aren't radiation.
What did you mention, ablation?
Yes, radio frequency ablation. I don't know if that exists for this type of tumor, but you should look. And you should also look at whether or not it could be surgically removed, whether you could have a second surgery. It depends on where it is. It's all sorts of special things that are individual.
Yeah, at the time of the surgery, they said I couldn't. It was very big. I had Kaiser for my insurance, and for a whole year, I had terrible pain in my head, and I just kept giving me pain meds and didn't do anything.
Okay. That's water under the bridge. Right?
I know, but I know what it's. But it's
so you should have a certain healthy distrust for single institutional advice and get yourself a second opinion.
Yeah, what I was saying, I was worried just because maybe it was so big when they did have to do it. Maybe they couldn't do it again. I don't know.
Well, you need to find that
out.
And that's a neurosurgical opinion, not okay, not an oncology opinion. So get your head scan and do some research and see what other therapies that might be potentially available. Find out where they're available locally in Northern California, and then go talk to the people who do them.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye. Unfortunately, or fortunately, we primary care doctors have been sort of squeezed out of our primary role, as I see it, which should be patient advocate. And we are encouraged to be kind of triage specialists and just move people through the system. I don't think that's the way to practice medicine, but I do think that's what is being financially rewarded and encouraged. So we have to watch out. There's a saying, you get what you pay for. You do, by the way, get what you pay for. Here's an interesting example of that. Just little news of the weird from the San Jose Mercury News. Tennessee, which is the second fattest state in the country, will not pay for Medicaid people to go to a dietitian. Even one dietetic visit is not covered. But they will, if you're fat enough, pay $2,000 for bariatric surgery, which has yet to be shown to actually improve length of life. Problem with bariatric surgery is that people lose a lot of weight, but they also develop significant vitamin deficiencies if they're not very careful. And because of perioperative morbidity and mortality, in other words, you destabilize the patient and some of them die, some of them live, but at least at the 10-year mark, we've yet to be able to show that bariatric surgery lengthens the lives of people who have it. Now, I'd like to see that data before we continue to pay for it. But we have a problem with Medicare. And the problem goes something like this. Medicare and Medicaid are both dominated by centralized agencies that decide what's going to get paid for. And these agencies are not elected. They're appointed. And they're appointed representatives from the major medical societies. And if you go and look at all of the major medical societies, you'll discover something very interesting. And maybe there is a reason for this. Each agency gets a vote. Each medical society gets a vote. But there are far more surgical societies than there are internal medicine societies. So we've got a lumper versus a splitter problem. Most of the individual societies are people who do procedures of some type or other. The non-procedure people who sit and think, the cognitive specialists, as they're called, tend to be lumped into a couple of large societies, whereas the surgical societies have figured this out and they have split into 100 little fragments, each of which gets a vote on these Medicare commissions. So when they decide what something's worth and what's going to be approved, the vote overwhelmingly goes in favor of more procedures being paid for more. And they don't get paid nearly as much for those procedures by Medicare as they do by, say, a private insurer, or didn't used to. But now what happens is that procedures are driving most of people's practice bottom lines. And so guess what you're going to get? If you pay for procedures, you're going to get procedures. You're not going to get people talking people out of procedures or avoiding procedures or doing medical management, because quite literally, there's no money in it. Now, that's not the way to run a healthcare system. And so I had to roll my eyes a little bit with Dennis Kucinich and the whole Medicare for All concept, because it's really not as simple as Medicare for All. What that would buy us is lots and lots and lots of unnecessary procedures. And I don't think that is how you run a healthcare system. While we're talking about how to run a healthcare system, for those of you who are in California, State Assembly Speaker John Perez is the person who is in the catbird seat as far as deciding whether or not the State Assembly holds hearings on Blue Shield's 59% increase. You heard me, 59% on individual health care plans. Now, Blue Shield agreed this week to delay for 60 days increasing their plan rates by 60%. That's just such a nice concession from them. The state has to hold hearings and decide to accept or decline this increase within that 60-day time. They can't rescind it afterwards. So it's important these hearings be held promptly. Now, it just so happens that last week, Blue Shield paid for a $100,000 fundraiser for Speaker Perez. So I'm thinking, I wonder exactly how busy the assembly schedule for hearings is going to be over the next 2 months. And I wonder if they might just kind of not get around to doing Blue Shield. It's just a little bit fishy, and I think the fix is in. And I think we need to write to Assembly Speaker John Perez, who is a Democrat from Los Angeles, and insist that hearings be held to prevent this unconscionable rate increase. This is gouging the most vulnerable people, who are the individuals who have to buy health insurance on the individual market. They don't have a group that they can be part of, and therefore they are completely unprotected from these rate increases. And the insurance company's response is, well, you know, the only people who would buy insurance at these outrageous rates must be people who are sick. Therefore, they're a bad risk, and we're going to kick the price up because we want every segment of our business to make a profit. Well, I'm sorry, but that's not how it works. You get to make money somewhere, and you get to lose money somewhere, and that's how the hospital industry and the doctors have been doing it for time immemorial. It's time for the insurance companies to do the additive bottom line and stop doing this to people who can really least afford it. That's Speaker John Perez, California State Assembly. I hope you've enjoyed this hour of Ask Dr. Don, and I hope that you will come back and listen next week at about this time. Furthermore, I hope that you will go to the website, askdrdon.com, maybe look at that Journal of Nutrition article, maybe think about thinking outside the box, and always, 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 what's your data on that, doctor? Can you show me your data on that pronouncement? This is Dr. Don saying so long, and stay healthy.